This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. And joining me now, I welcome back Helen Joyce, the author of Trans When Ideology Meets Reality and Director of Advocacy for Sex Matters in the United Kingdom. Helen, good morning and welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So good to have you back. And since we spoke last, a lot of water has gone under the, you know, gender bridge. WPATH, CAS, I mean, what has changed from now to then? Well, then to now.
I mean, in some ways, it feels like Groundhog Day, you know, like every time we think we make progress, it's as if the people in all the many areas that have bought this, frankly, bullshit, just haven't got the memo. So, but then I have to think like where we were 5 years ago or even 2 years ago. And yes, it is progress. So as you say, there was that big expose on WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which sounds like it's a very august body, doesn't it? But it's not. It's just a membership body, and they put out absolute barking mad stuff like their latest standards of care has an entire chapter on eunuch gender identity. So like if you want to get your testicles cut off and say that that's because that's your identity, they have a chapter on how to do it. So there's a big expose of doctors who are members of WPATH talking behind the scenes, and the way they talk about their patients was just shocking. And then, of course, Dr. Hilary Cass, the eminent paediatrician who is commissioned by the UK government to spend 4 years looking at standards of care in youth gender medicine, and who brought out a very painstaking report that had an evidence review of everything that's known, said that the evidence was remarkably weak, that interventions were being done without a proper basis. And the result of that has been that puberty blockers are now not available in the UK at all, except for the kids who are already on them. So not in the NHS and not privately either. So you just can't get them. If they run a trial of puberty blockers, you'll be able to get them on the trial, but that's it.
Mm.
Yeah, so like that is progress, because these things were meant to be settled, according to the activists. Settle science. They knew what they were doing. The rest of us were bigots.
Has the CAS report in the United Kingdom put enough barriers up to actually allow some of these parents and children to take a pause and take stock and actually let time take, you know, the most effective treatment?
It's really difficult because the activists were given free rein for so long to suggest sell these drugs as life-saving. That's what they always say about it, that it's life-saving care, medically necessary and life-saving. They say that it's suicide prevention. They say that, like the activists after CAS brought out a report, they went on protest marches with banners saying CAS kills kids, CAS is social murder. So if that's who you're listening to, you think that she must be basically a fascist, like really the worst person alive, that she's a murderer and wants trans kids dead. So those kids now feel desperate because they can't get the thing they were told was the answer to their problems. And they are very unhappy. Like these kids are really distressed. I mean, that said, these drugs are not good medicine, so they shouldn't be available. But like, that's not an answer to the kids who think they are good medicine because they've been misled. We have a long road back here.
Mm. Yeah. Well, indeed a very long road back. So these kids, and I also want to talk about some of these parents too. I mean, I see it here. I said to you just before we got started, I'm part of the hand knitting industry, and I know of five mothers who have trans children in, within the industry. And it's New Zealand. It's tiny. I mean, that's not a trend. That's a fashion.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but like when they've been told that this is a thing, like that it's real to have a gender identity that doesn't match your body, and they've been told that doctors know what they're meant to do, and they've been told that if they don't do what the doctors say, their child is at risk of suicide. You know, there are plenty of parents who went along with this with grave misgivings. They just didn't know what else to do. And also parents who were very much blindsided when their child came out of nowhere. It turned out their child had basically been radicalized online. Like they'd found web, you know, web pages and sites where you're told how to bring this up with your parents and you're told what to say with any pushback from your parents. But there are also parents who are the ones who are in the driving seat here, especially when you see very little children being transitioned. When somebody says they have a trans 2 or 3 or 4 year old, it's like that thing about the vegan cat. You know, there are no vegan cats. It's the owner. I would never dunk on an individual parent like this, because let's remember that they are doing what most medical authorities say is right, that you let the child lead, and that you believe a child who says that they were born in the wrong body, or that despite appearances, they're really a girl or really a boy. But yeah, some of the parents do seem rather happy to have the latest accessory, don't they?
Oh, certainly do. You see those in the gossip pages, and I just look, and like, but there's one actress in particular I can think of, and I think all of her children are trans. This is really. And they're little kids. I'm fully accepting if you've got adult children who are all gay, and I know families where that can be the case, but these are little kids. I mean, all little kids want to do is please their parents, isn't it?
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff that goes on. I mean, little kids don't tell you they're gay anyway. It's older kids who tell you that they're gay. And also, they aren't being put on a medicalized pathway. So you can just say, oh, that's nice, dear. You know, you're too young to be sleeping with anybody of either sex, or whatever you do when they're a bit older, whatever you do, like, be careful. Don't get an infection. Don't get pregnant, if that's a possibility, with the sort of sex you're having. You know, don't get raped, those sorts of things. But there isn't an activist industry out there telling a child who says that they're gay that they need to change their body, that they need to get sterilized, that they need to try to force everybody else to tell a lie about what they can see about that person, that other people need to give up their rights to single-sex spaces, sports, all of that sort of thing, and that other people need to be kicked out of their jobs if they just state biological reality. So this is quite different from having a family where there's more than one gay person. About 15 years ago, the estimates of how many adults, not children, adults, were transsexual in the old phrase was 1 in 30,000 men and 1 in 120,000 women. So that was the incidence rate before this became a social contagion. And now, like, you should never see, at that sort of rate, you should never see more than one in your life unless you're very well travelled and constantly meeting people. You certainly wouldn't see two in the same town, like small town, and as for two in the same family, goodness me.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things that I learned, particularly with your book, and if people haven't read the book or they want to know more about this issue, you actually break it all down with the histories, and they're two quite distinct threads, channels with this. And one is the male to female transition, which is usually in adulthood. It's what we're used to seeing. There's usually a fetish element involved or some sort of sexual desire there that is driving it. And then you have the social contagion element with these young girls and these children. So they're two very, very different sides of the same coin. With the CAS report, I really do hope with the latter group that there have been some improvements and there have been some progress, because I've also seen for myself personally, a lot of parents now waking up with that CAS report. They're actually now asking questions. The constant affirmation. Yeah, the constant affirmation, particularly from school, is now they're going, well, actually, and they're starting to ask more questions. So that, I guess, is a positive thing. And the other group that I've seen wake up, have started to find their voices a little bit, have actually been not only lesbian women who've been quite vocal in this space, but also gay men are seeing this, that the great conundrum of, we have conversion therapy that was very lauded and passed in this country. And of course, the transitioning of these little boys is, to me, the conversion therapy of the very worst kind.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more than two strands. There are many strands. Like, you know, trans is not one thing. Trans is many things. And it's completely different for men and women, or boys and girls. But even within boys and girls, it's different as well. So if you go back 20 or more years, what you'll have seen is that nearly everyone who wanted to transition was either a young gay man who was hyper feminine and felt that he'd fit in better as a girl. And often those men had their heads screwed on, you know, like, it's awful that society would be so unwelcoming to an effeminate gay man that that's what he'd think. But anyway, they knew what they were doing. I don't know that it always worked out quite as they hoped, but anyway, that's what they were doing. And then these older men who had been cross-dressing in secret or perhaps in clubs for a long, long time for fetishistic or erotic reasons. And basically the woman inside became bigger and bigger part of their personality. And often in their 50s, 40s or 50s, when the kids are older, and it's kind of the last frontier is womanhood, and these are hard charging men, and they want to get the last achievement. So those are heterosexual men, and they're not at all feminine. I mean, not that women have to be feminine, but I'm just saying they aren't. So we've known that, like, the early sexologists a century ago knew that there were those two different types of men, and they were named even in the 1990s as two different groups by sexologists. And then among women, there were much fewer, but the women who wanted to transition were almost exclusively hyper-butch lesbians. And again, they had their heads screwed on. Like, it's awful to think that a woman who wants to live in that way might feel that she'd just be better off taking testosterone and having people think she's a man. But that is what people thought. And that's what they did. You didn't see straight women transitioning. It just wasn't a thing. And you certainly didn't ever consider transitioning kids. The clinics did sometimes hear of or have somebody brought to them who was a little boy, a very little boy, who said, "I was meant to be a girl," almost never the other way around. But those kids grew up to be gay. So, they were just very gender nonconforming kids who worked out what was what when puberty came along and they started to feel sexual desire. And now we've got this new cohort, which is by far the largest cohort, which is teenage girls. And that didn't even exist before 2010. It just wasn't a thing. There wasn't a paper written about it, not one research paper. And now they predominate in gender clinics around the world. And I would argue that there is another emergent group too. The people working in this field are somewhat in disagreement over this, but this is boys who are hyper online. Mm. And they maybe look at online porn, but even if they don't, they're playing computer games in which they have avatars that they customize. They're perhaps autistic, they're socially unaware. They think that living as a girl is life on easy mode. That's one of the things that you get told in the manosphere, that girls get it easy, that a man will, that if you're not an A-grade man, you're not butch, you're not strong, you're not muscular, you're not going to make it as an alpha dog. You could become a girl and you get a sugar daddy and you could get sex all the time and you could go on the game. And I mean, who knows what? They just get such a false idea of femininity and femaleness. But I don't think those boys are either of the two previous sorts. They're not fetishistic cross-dressers, and often they're not gay.
Mm.
We created them. We created them with social media, with computer games. I have to say COVID didn't help. The lockdowns really didn't help. A lot of kids spent 2 years seeing nobody else online. And there are groomers trying to groom kids into transition on sites like Reddit. There are adult men whose fun and games is interacting with kids, boys in particular, and getting them to transition because, I don't know, that's their kicks. Shits and giggles, I guess.
I've done a number of interviews around porn, kids being online, and we're seeing a wave of depression amongst adolescents in this country. I don't know what it's like in the UK.
Exactly the same, yeah.
Exactly the same. And one of the things is around that dopamine hit that these kids are getting with screen time, with being online, as you said, the games, the avatars. I mean, it's almost like chasing an addiction.
I guess I must say I just don't know enough about it. That sounds right, but I don't know enough that I can say more than yes, very intriguing mm-hmm. hypothesis. But I mean, one thing I should have said is that something I'm very interested in and that I don't think has been written about hardly at all is that while the boys are looking at porn, and girls are to some extent too, but mostly it's boys, and the girls are being influenced by it because they know what the boys at their age are looking at. And if they're starting to be sexually active, they'll see what the boys are looking at in effect in the bedroom. But simultaneously, the girls are looking at things and reading things on fan fiction websites, on sites like used to be Tumblr, but now it's more TikTok. They're watching videos. And those things have their own sort of ratcheting up of quite pornified memes and patterns and ideas. So fan fiction, which is, just fiction written about the characters from an original like Harry Potter or Marvel Avengers or Doctor Who or whatever, there's millions and millions of stories like that on several enormous sites. And you can easily get a sense of what's on them because you can search for the tags and you can just see numbers. So, I mean, I was doing this yesterday to see, because I'm thinking about this poor woman, Gisèle Pelicot in France, this woman who was raped many times in her sleep. So of the 13 million stories on archive of our own, 500,000 of them have the tag non-con, which means non-consensual. And these are written by girls and young women, for girls and young women. So one in 26 of the stories has the tag non-con, non-consensual. Now, there has always been rape and near rape in women's written erotica. That is a feature. But this is kids. These are sites that adults don't even know to be checking what their daughters are reading and writing. And these, and there's another strange thing is these tags are kind of just all mixed up. They're, you just, there's no rule about how you tag. You just write any tags you think of. And so you'll be reading, it'll be going like Ron bashing, non-con, anal, slow burn, happy ever after, dark AU, which means alternate universe, just all mixed up. And that's what kids will go to after they finished reading Harry Potter or after they finished watching Doctor Who. You want more. You know, I wish that Jane Austen was still around writing more. You go and you find the next stories. There's literally, I think it's 500,000 stories for Harry Potter. You will find very porn-affected stories. So now, sorry, this has been a rather long, convoluted thing. But anyway, my point is, that's what girls think is what sexual encounters are going to be like. So it's what they expect of the boys. And the boys are watching porn. So it's what they expect too. So each of them thinks the other expects it. And maybe neither of them is happy. But each of them is right to think the other expects it. To expect these practices that are very pornified, like anal, like hitting, like choking, like spitting. Yeah, that's the world we've created online. And people are waking up to the fact that teenage boys are looking at porn. But they are absolutely blindly unaware of what the girls are reading and being told in sites that they use.
Yeah, well, we're certainly having pushback in this country because a lot of the things that you just discussed there has been added in as part of the guidelines for the sexual education of our children in public schools.
Yeah, there's some of that here too. Yeah, the idea is, you know, they're going to come across it anyway, so let them know. And the thing is, you know, I think a lot of the people who are saying this, they're thinking of the, you know, the page three pictures and the girly mags of the 1990s and 80s. And there's kind of a sort of a point in there somewhere of, you know, you don't want people to think that that's what the opposite sex looks like naked. You want them to understand that this is something separate. You want them to understand that it's show business, basically, that it's not real life. But I mean, it's out of the box now and adults have no idea. Like the age difference is extraordinary. Like I've tried this. I've tried talking to people under 30 and over 30 about fan fiction. And basically under 30, young women and girls are saying, I don't actually know what you're trying to tell me. They know this. They thought everybody knew it. And they don't understand what my point is. And over 30, they're going, sorry, come again? Tell me again? Who's paying these people to write this stuff? What do you mean non-con? Like I was talking to a lawyer who he's actually an academic and he teaches law about consent. And when I told him this thing about all these tags, the dubcon is another one, dubious consent. So dubcon, non-con, consensual non-consent, which is when you set things up so that it's a role, like a game play, that it's non-consensual, but you've consented to it beforehand. And he just sat there and he went like this. He said, this is the most depressing thing I have ever heard. And he's quite young. He's only about 30. But I tell you, find someone 25 or so, and they just won't know what you're even talking about because this is their world. They didn't know you didn't know this.
I know that I interviewed Heidi Olsen, who is a sexual nurse. Have you know of Heidi? Yeah. And she blew my little mind with a lot of this information that I heard for the first time with what these kids were looking at, but also the ages of children that were perpetrating the sexual assault. So, of course, in my head, I'm thinking dirty men abusing small children, which apparently is a very early 2000s notion, very pre-2007, she told me. And now she said it. Most of the lead perpetrators are under 15. The children on children.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, children need guardrails. Children need adults to be there for them. Children need to hear no. They need to be supervised. They need things that are dangerous for them, like tattoos and cigarettes and porn, just out of their way. They, you know, whatever about saying that an adult can make those choices for themselves, a child can't. It's adults who make those choices for children.
And when the guardrails are set, particularly within this gender space, where you've got educators and then a medical fraternity that work on a positive affirmation model, so anything that the patient or child comes to them with has to be affirmed, I mean, what message does that send?
I mean, I don't think people have even begun to reckon with what it means for adults to tell lies to children and to tell them blatantly and obviously, and to tell them before the children are even old enough to conceptualize what it means that something is a lie. You know, children, it's between 3 and 7, they say, but it's mostly near to 3. Children work out that there are 2 types of humans, male and female, and that it's not about the clothes or hair. So when they're 2, if you take a figurine of a boy, and you, in front of the child, take off the boy clothes and put on girl clothes and give it a wig and say, what is it now? They'll say a girl. And then at 3 or 4, or maybe a little later, they'll understand, no, it's a boy. It's still a boy, but he's wearing a wig and a dress. And if you've got in there before this ever happens, and you tell them that it's possible for this sort of body to just be a girl inside, and that the way you would show that is by putting on the clothes, you interrupt a really, really important developmental pathway that human beings have done since we've had words, really, to talk about and to say male and female and boy and girl. But also, you are lying, and children do know that you're lying. I mean, they may be confused, but there's an awareness that they can see one thing and you're saying another. Well, maybe you could do that about something else as well. You know, maybe about dead and alive, maybe about good and bad, maybe about adult and child, wrong and right. I mean, I don't know if you've come across this thing that, you know, last year there was this meme that children were starting to identify as cats. And this came up in a news story here in the UK, and it was in a secret recording that a child made in school. And she was telling her teacher that her teacher was wrong to say that there were more than 2 sexes and that your sex was what you identified as. And the teacher told her that she was bad, that she was going to be referred to the head teacher for being a bigot. And the girl said something like, well, what are you saying? Like, if I identified as a cat, then I'd be a cat. That's ridiculous. And it got completely twisted to her saying that there was a child in her school who was identifying as a cat. And everyone said, oh, you know, that's just a meme. That's the Trump meme. It's Republicans in America. It's just the far right. Well, I can tell you, I talk to teachers all the time. There's a lot of children now suddenly identifying as cats. So why? Because there was a big load of news stories about it last year. That's the way it works. It's another bit of social contagion.
Yeah. I spoke to a friend of mine who's a journalist actually the other day, and we were talking about this, and he was telling me how he was driving down the main street in the suburb that he lived, and here was this woman of a social milieu, let's put it this way, of a very expensive car outside a very expensive school, and he saw the daughter get out, he said young teen, and then she's there putting her ears, her mask, putting her paws, adjusting her tail to get ready to go off into school. And I was like, really? Really?
Yeah, the teachers I talked to said that nobody at this point was doing the whole thing of putting down a litter tray or anything like that, because I've heard about that online and I'm really not sure it's happening. But anyway, it's not happening in the UK as far as I know. But what they all said, all the teachers who told me about this, it was 2 teachers and 1 parent in different schools, I should say, and spontaneously told me, I wasn't even asking them about it. What they all said was that they just didn't know what to do. So the teachers were saying, I don't know what I'm meant to do, because the thing is, if you are willing to say that the boy is really a girl or the girl is really a boy, then why can't you say that they're really a cat? So that's my big issue with all of this, like on top of the problem of taking away the safeguarding, the women's rights, you know, the gay conversion therapy mark, you know, version 2.0, like you say, my big problem is the destruction of meaning and reality.
This, in a way, segues into your advocacy work with Sex Matters a little. So tell me a little bit about what you've been doing, particularly, I think you put forward some guidelines, is that correct? You did that just prior to the election. So just walk us through that, because I think that will give us a picture of some of the work that's going on there that they're hoping to emulate over here.
Sure. So, I mean, gosh, we're doing quite a lot of different things, including, and we found out yesterday that we've been given permission to intervene in a Supreme Court hearing on the question of what the word woman means in the Equality Act. So that sounds very technical, but basically the Equality Act here rolled all the various anti-discrimination laws into one. And it did that in 2010, which was after we brought in a Gender Recognition Act. So the question is whether the words woman and man, male and female in that law mean after you've got a gender recognition certificate, or it really means what, you know, man, woman, boy, girl, male, female, the real words. And it's reached the Supreme Court and we're intervening in that because we think it's quite crucial that the categories of woman and female have their actual biological meanings in anti-discrimination law, because frankly, we're not being discriminated against on our gender essences. We're being discriminated against on the material reality of being female. So that's one set of things we're doing: legal work, legal advice to people who are experiencing discrimination because they believe that sex is real, trying to, you know, find the most useful places to leverage the wins we've had already, like my colleague Maya Forstatter's win, which meant that you can say that sex is real in the workplace without losing your job. We think schools are really vital because, well, for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is it's kids. You know, you don't, like, whatever's bad, it's worse if it's happening to kids. Another one is that most people actually really get that you shouldn't be lying to kids. So even people who think be kind, like, okay, you know, this man isn't really a woman, but he wants it so badly that he'd be very mean not to say it. Even those people get that lying to kids is a bad idea and that you can't keep kids safe if you lie to them about sex. So we've been doing a lot of work on schools and we have produced guidance which we think fits the law, human rights, safeguarding on how to run a school with sex-based policies for everybody. It's not about trans-identifying kids, it's about everybody. And we did a lot of work engaging with the government. The last government, the Conservative government, brought out draft guidance that was really pretty good. Like, it wasn't quite all the way there, but it was pretty good. And now the new Labour government that came in a few months ago, we hope that it'll take that work up and that it'll publish it and make it, not draft, like make a final version. So we're engaging a lot on that too. I think they'd be, maybe those are the two big things I'd highlight for this interview.
Yeah. The current government, I mean, they are a Labour government, so their social policies tend to be a little bit more liberalised, or they certainly are in this country. But on this issue, so far, they seem to have been maintaining status quo. So are you hopeful that, as you said, you're kind of hoping that they will have they indicated one way or t'other, or are they still just sort of seeing the lay of the land and fighting fires? Well, especially the favourability rating of the Prime Minister, for starters. But
it's tough times, very tough times to be a new leader, isn't it? I'm quite sure that Keir Starmer thinks this is a fringe issue. And I can really see why. Like, think of everything else that's going on in the world. Think of the Middle East, Ukraine, energy prices, cost of living, you know, the whole lot. There's so much going on. And we've had a lot of strikes here, a lot of public sector strikes too. So I think he just devoutly wishes this issue would go away. And that was very much what they tried to signal before the election. Like, it's a culture war. We will end the culture wars on day one, which is a very stupid thing to say, because you can't end a war on one side only. Especially the side, you know, like, they just want us to shut up, basically. But we're not the combatants. We're not the ones who are trying to take people's rights away from them. They are. So that he's been disabused of that idiotic idea, at least. I don't think he can possibly think that men can really be women. He's not an idiot, and he is a lawyer. And by the way, I should say something else, which is that all of the nonsense here happened under right-wing government. And we have had the right-wing prime ministers. No, 14 since 2010. Wow. Since 2010, yep. So we had the attempt to bring in gender self-ID, all the promises about conversion therapy, all the allowing practices to get way beyond the law, like way outside the law, public sector capture, schools going insane, all of that happened under Tory governments. So yes, it's true that most of the more ardent campaigners for trans nonsense are on the left than on the right. But the right-wing government didn't stop it, did it?
No.
So what do we expect from this government? Well, they did signal that they thought that the school's guidance was good when it came out in draft form. The woman who's now our education secretary was the shadow education secretary at the time, and she welcomed it on the day it came out. She didn't have to. She could have stayed quiet. So that's good. More importantly, Wes Streeting, our health secretary, who's a big, real shining star inside Labour. Like, he's one of the people, the half dozen or so people that they say, like, future prime minister, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's a gay man, so that's very helpful on this issue. He has welcomed the CAS review. He has said repeatedly that they are going to implement the CAS recommendations in full. He upheld the ban on puberty blockers, even though he came under horrific criticism. So there's this trans lobby group that was saying things like, there will be... children's ashes will be poured outside number 10 Downing Street. They'll be put outside the health department. You know, Wes Streeting has blood on his hands, like literally this sort of rhetoric. He didn't budge. So that's a good sign, I think. Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think he really gets it. I think he really, really understands that he's one of those gay men you mentioned who probably some years ago thought, oh, well, this is just gay rights 2.0. This is the next group that needed their civil rights. And now he understands how harmful it is for gay people in particular.
Oh, absolutely. So then that dovetails into the language war, because there's a linguistic element to all of this. It always has been the gymnastics that get played, that up is down and down is up. So then the online safety bill that you now have across there, which of course, again, they're trying to get iterations of that here. We've seen in the media people being arrested for saying things that seem relatively innocuous and often factually correct. So how does this going, how, because trans radical activists not afraid of coming forward and hunting out and actively being proactive to seek prosecutions or arrests and the like. So have they weaponized that bill against those people?
Totally. Yeah. At the UK wide level, it's still under discussion. Online harms, I think it's called. But that Scotland passed a hate speech law actually 3 or 4 years ago, and it suspended it for a few years before bringing it into force because the police said they weren't ready. They said, you know, it was a completely ridiculous law. It covered things that were said inside your own home. It covered saying that trans women are men, or that even just that they're male. It was entirely perception-based. So, you know, no real objective tests of whether something really was hateful. And also, when hate crimes were brought in first, there's no freestanding hate crime. What there was if something was already a crime, it could attract a higher penalty if there was a hate element. Which, I mean, okay, you can disagree or agree whether that's a good idea, but at least, you know, saying, well, this person beat somebody up on the street, this person beat somebody up on the street and called them a faggot or used the N-word. Like, at least they're very objective, and at least there has to be a crime first. But that was none of this in the Scottish bill. So, you know, the women I know were very, very afraid that they were going to be reported straight away by trans activists. And there were trans activists saying, we will do that. They were saying it online, you know, go after these people, like listing Twitter accounts and so on. Well, J.K. Rowling tweeted on the first day and she listed a whole load of prominent and very nasty trans women. Like, she just picked the ones who, you know, call women all sorts. And you can imagine the sort of thing. And she just said, every one of them are men. They're all men. And if you want to come after me, come after me. And it forced the police and the Scottish First Minister to say what she said wasn't a crime. And then she said, OK, anyone else says something like that? And if that's all you say, I'll repeat it and they can come after me too. And it basically blew it out of the water. Like it just made it almost impossible to continue with this stupid law. What I'm very worried about at the UK-wide level is making misogyny a hate crime. So, I mean, it sounds like I'd be for that, because certainly those of us who argue on my side of the gender wars experience constant, incredible, extreme, toxic misogyny. Like the things we are called, the rape threats, the disgusting sexualized insults, it's so misogynistic. But we all know that a trans woman will count as a woman for this law. And if it comes into force with misogyny as one of the protected strands, extreme misogyny, I should say, I'm pretty sure that the first person to be prosecuted under it will be a woman. And their so-called misogyny will have been saying that a man is a man.
Yeah, it is just absolute bonkers. I know the Australians are fighting it. Selgrover is fighting it quite heavily at the moment around having gender characteristics entrenched as part of their human rights fabric. And they're trying to do it here too. I mean, the big fight that we've had in this country at the moment is with the guidelines, with the Midwifery Council. And they've tried to remove mother and baby out of the guidelines. You know, because, I mean, what have mothers and babies got to do with the midwifery service at all, really? And just replace it with a generic word, whānau, which is the Māori word for family. And, you know, again, it's a linguistic war that they're trying to wage. And those in the committee that were part of the ones compiling the guidelines, shock, horror, one of them has associations with Pātha, another one is non-binary, another one is very keen on writing all of these laws. So it was very one-directional in its thinking, and they're now receiving pushback. So that's currently at a petition stage in government to try and have a select committee meeting. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that will get pushed back. But it's you must get tired, Helen. Do you ever sit back and think with a cup of tea or a wine, I hope, actually?
I wish
I was writing at The Economist and life was so much easier then.
I mean, I wish this hadn't happened. Like, I don't wish that it had happened and I'd looked away. I mean, I was being driven mad by it. It was it's so crazy making. That's part of the reason it happens, by the way. Like, so many people look at it and think this is so bonkers that it cannot be happening, and that anyone who says it's happening has a tinfoil hat. But it is happening. And once you see it, it can be very hard to look away. So no, I don't wish that I had walked away. I really thought it wouldn't be so hard, because it's so stupid, Marie. It's just so dumb. This is the most stupid movement, surely, in history. Like, nobody would believe it. If you'd written a dystopian novel 25 years ago that said we're going to, in a future world, we're going to pretend that male and female aren't real things, and that people are assigned their sex at birth, and that what they declare themselves to be is more important and more meaningful than the sheer irrelevance of their bodies, and, you know, a mother of a baby isn't any different than the father of the baby, etc., etc. No one would have believed it. It just would have been laughed out. You wouldn't have been able to sell that book. People would have said, too stupid. Anyway, that's the world we live in now. So yes, it's depressing sometimes that something so incredibly dumb has managed to get such traction. And it just shows you what you can do if you get in early in people's lives. Like, without grown-ups realising this nonsense was taught in school and university for a long time. So now we have a generation that's been indoctrinated in it. So I worry about that, because that generation is probably the generation that's up to, say, age 30 or so, maybe 35. And the craven cowards who are older than them, who aren't willing to say to young people, listen, you don't have a clue. Don't be ridiculous. And we're not having that bullshit in this workplace. I have hope that the teenagers who are coming out now, I hear from some of them that the kids a bit older than them, the ones who are in their early 20s, are just absolutely mad. Mm. And the boys in particular say that the girls are completely insane.
Oh, the boys are getting
it. So there's a pushback there.
Totally.
Yeah, but we have this cohort. We have about 15 years in which we allow people to be indoctrinated. And those people are soon going to be running HR departments. In fact, a lot of them already are. Like, it's one of the worst parts of a company is the HR departments, the she-hers and the HR department.
Yeah, I know. It's certainly something that we're going to have to watch out and push back for. In terms of looking at things from a global perspective, I know that the GenSpec had held a conference in Lisbon just recently. You were there. So what, in talking to other people that are fighting this fight, what were some of the highlights and outcomes that you had from that time away in Portugal?
Sure. So for your listeners, GenSpec is quite a new organisation that takes an open-ended and ethical approach to supporting gender-distressed children. So it was set up to be kind of the anti-WPATH. So WPATH is just like, you know, gender insanity, lunacy. I mean, I can't even begin to describe how bonkers they are. Like, much worse than anything you could imagine. You just have to go and look at their statements and you realise how bonkers they are. Anyway, so WPATH does these conferences. And 18 months ago, there was one in Killarney, Ireland, which is very near where Stella O'Malley, obviously I'm Irish, she's Irish too. It's very near where she's from. And she said to one of her friends, we should have a conference at the same time in the same town. And she did. She pulled it off. And it was great. I was there. The saddest thing for me about that conference, the hardest thing, was meeting the parents. There were a lot of parents who had come who have trans-identifying kids. They see it doesn't make the kid any happier. In fact, it makes them worse. There's a lot of parental alienation. There's a lot of parents absolutely frantically trying to stop their children from taking irrevocable steps that they're sure the child will regret. A lot of kids who are saying that their children have untreated or undiagnosed mental illness or conditions like autism. And those parents being shut out of their children's lives, briefed behind their backs by counsellors, therapists, teachers, and so on. And talking to those parents is very hard. Like, meeting them and hearing their stories, you realise that there's this absolutely terrible thing that's happening and they've no one to talk to. So they were there really to talk to other people. So then there was another conference in Denver, which I didn't make it to. And then the third GenSpec was in Lisbon, each time because that's where WPATH or USPATH were. And it was great. You know, a lot of really good talks, a lot of therapists saying extremely interesting things about their ethical, evidence-based work with these kids. Some detransitioners giving excellent advice to therapists on how to look after them. But the big thing that jumped out for me was the parents were different. They were starting to get organised. Many of them had come in groups from the same place where they worked with and supported each other. And some of the stories is just as sad. Like, it's people saying, I haven't heard from the child for 2 years now, or, well, my son went off to Thailand and got castrated. But, like, it's like they're processing And you can't say moving on. No one moves on from these things. But something like picking themselves up and keeping moving and starting to think about how they can be politically active, how they can start to fight back. Like one woman came up to me and she said, my daughter turns 18 in a few months. And after that, you know, she can do what she wants. I can't stop her. You know, at the moment she can because her child is a minor. And she said, so once, you know, once it's out of my hands, I want to start speaking publicly. And also she doesn't want to talk about a child who's a minor, you know. And she wanted some hints on how you don't get nervous, how you don't let your voice wobble, how you control what you say and plan and so on. Basically, she wanted some media training, I guess. And nobody was talking like that 18 months ago. And she was with a group. The other women were waiting to hear what was said to her and they were trying to work out what they needed to do next. Yeah. So it's a very good thing that Genspect has done. I mean, really, you know, out of nothing, they have managed to create a genuine alternative narrative to the WPATH narrative, and hats off to them.
Well, and also to those voices, those combined voices together. I mean, that was the beautiful happy accident of both the WPATH file leaks and the CAS report being released so close together, is that it thrust this out in the conversation for a time. And I think a lot of parents and teachers and educators found each other. I had a conversation with a senior educator at an all-girls school a few months back, which I know through a mutual friend, and she wasn't aware that I was doing this part-time as a job. She knew me. She knew what I did as my other day job. And I told her some of the things that we were talking about. And she's at a high school. And she looked at me and she went, oh, about time. Someone's talking about it. Yeah. You know, they're exasperated. They're exasperated.
More than exasperated. People feel like they're in the upside down, you know? You feel like you've rambled off the path and people are saying absolutely crazy things. Like almost as if you're in a psychology experiment and you're waiting for someone else to speak up. You're looking around and nobody's saying anything and they're all repeating the slogans. You know, it feels like one of those John Wyndham novels like Day of the Triffid or The Kraken Wakes or something like that. I think it's Day of the Triffid that the guy wakes up in hospital and he's got a bandage on his eyes and the noises are all wrong. And basically, you know, the whole world has been taken over by these walking plants. Yeah. It does feel like that. Pod people or something.
Yeah, yeah. No, my husband always talks about Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It sort of has that feeling about it. The other, I spoke to last week, actually, I had on Vaishnavi Sundar, and she talked about her trans widows, and you featured heavily in that documentary. And
see, you noticed, Mary, that I got the one and only F-bomb into that.
I did notice. I did notice. Sweary Helen came out to play.
And standing up for my Irish nationality there. She could have cut it if she wanted.
No, she was so inspiring. Gosh, what an incredible woman. And again, that film opened another window that I hadn't looked out of and really understood. And there was a quote in there that, and you brought it up earlier in terms of what they believe, these men especially believe, and there was the one young Muslim teacher, and she was talking about her trans-identified husband, and she said, well, if you're going to be a woman, then are you going to help me with the children, the cooking and the cleaning and all the housework? And she said, no, for him it's all about the shoes and the glittery nail polish. And I think that sums it up perfectly, really, for so many of them. That's this myth of womanhood that they've created in their own minds. But
I mean, the experience of wanting to be a woman when you're not is an experience that only a man can have. So when they say, I feel like I was meant to be a woman, well, I can't feel that. No woman can feel that because I just am a woman. It's just a fact. So it's a really ineradicably male thing to feel. And of course, they do it in a typically male way. Like, I often think I see the differences between men and women more when I look at the men and women who pretend that they aren't men and women than with anyone else. Like, these men, they are so bloody domineering. They get very angry with women who won't do what they're told. They're much worse than men who accept that they're men. A friend of mine, an American guy, who really lovely guy, who moved in very left-wing circles, you know, would have thought that there was some merit to queer theory before it all went insane, you know. He said to me that a decent man learns as he grows up that when you're in mixed company or when you're talking to women, you kind of have to modulate yourself a bit because you're bigger, you're stronger, you're louder, your voice is deep. And if you don't rein yourself in a little bit, you're flattening the women around you and you mustn't do that. But then if that man identifies as a woman, he gives himself total license to be his worst self again, because of course he's a woman now. Mm. And my God, they talk over us. They shout us down. They get cross when we won't do what we're told in a way that really a man would notice that it was pretty misogynistic if he did it when he was identifying as a man. Yeah, so I just see men when I look at them. I think, you know, you think it's all about the boobs. You think it's all about the boobs and the shoes, but men all think it's all about the boobs and the shoes. Like before this madness, do you remember that episode of Friends where Joey buries himself in the sand and then he builds these enormous sand boobs and he's feeling them? Or that joke that men used to say, like, if I had boobs, I'd never be able to stop playing with them.
Mm. Well,
like,
I mean,
that's what they're like. They're like men, these trans women. They're not like women. We're not like that.
Just look at Ronnie Barker and Nurse Gladys Emmanuel. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like the hoiking the boobs up. Like, men are just really obsessed with tits. And women don't tend to be very obsessed with tits. So, you know, so then they think that if they've got tits, they're a woman. It's like, well, yes, because that's what men think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly don't get into the minds of women, that's for sure. Look, Helen, it's always a joy to talk to you. Of course, this is Helen Joyce, the author of Trans When Ideology Meets Reality. It's available everywhere, people. And if you've heard any of this and you think, well, how did this start? I don't understand. My head is bursting. The book disseminates everything beautifully. You break it down into chapters. It's easy to understand. I mean, the big thing again from the book, the flimsiest of premises that all of this started with, like wafer thin, flimsy, like someone had a bad idea and it's turned into this. Oh, anyway, you outline it beautifully in the book. So I do thoroughly recommend that as probably your starter journal if you want to head down this gender journey and find out where what's what. And also you're the director of advocacy of Sex Matters in the UK. And yep, where else can people find you? Are you writing anywhere else, Helen, that they can look up? Or is that enough to get you done of a day?
Sure. I'll say that the book has been reprinted under the title Trans, Gender Identity and the New Battle for Women's Rights. So you may find it under either of those titles. It's the same book. I've only written one book. So yeah, either way. I have a website, thehelenjoyce.com, and I also write a monthly column in The Critic, which is available online. People often say, what are you going to write for your second book? But the first one nearly killed me. I never get a chance to draw breath. There's so much work fighting back pushing back the tide of absolute bullshit. But I do hope that I will at some point. I'm mulling over some ideas.
Oh, it could be internet tagging, decoding, a dictionary for beginners. I don't know. There you go. The things you wade into. Helen, it's been an absolute joy. This is Helen Joyce. Thank you very much for joining me today in Counterculture with Reality.
Thanks for having me on, Mary.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.